plans for university, our lives, but I ignored her.
What happened to your application? Did they schedule your interview?
No, nothing yet.
I told her to give me her number, to hang up so that I could call her back.
Oh, no, don't bother,
Aiming said.
These phone cards are so cheap, just a penny a minute.
She had a hint of New York in her English now, a tension that hadn't been there before. In both San Francisco and New York, she'd been working different jobs, waitress, house cleaner, nanny, tutor. At first, in the newness of America, her letters had glimmered with observations, jokes, and stories. Ma and I had visited her twice in San Francisco, where, despite everything, she had seemed happy. But after she moved to New York in 1993, we didn't see her anymore. Aiming always said it wasn't the right time. She was living in a dormitory and couldn't receive visitors. Her hours were erratic. She was working night shifts. Still, her letters arrived like clockwork. Aiming didn't write about the present anymore, but about things she remembered from Beijing or from her childhood. In 1995, when Congress passed Section 245I of the Immigration and Nationality Act, we thought she would gain legal status within the year. On the phone now, I didn't know what to say. There was static now, all of a sudden. Aiming, how are things, really?
Marie, my English has improved so much. They won't be able to turn me down.
Her laugh seemed to come from someone else.
As soon as I have my papers, I'm going home. My mother... It's nothing, only...
Behind her, I heard a machine rattling.
You'll come to New York soon, won't you?
Of course.
But even as I said the words, I had no idea how such a trip would be possible. Ma and I were as broke as we had ever been. You're 17 already. If we crossed on the street, maybe I wouldn't recognize you.
I'm just the same, only taller.
I mean, I have a new joke.
What did the Buddhist birthday card say?
She was already giggling. It said, not thinking of you. Mali, how many Buddhists does it take to screw in the light bulb?
Zero.
They are the light bulb.
The machinery behind her seemed to laugh in counterpoint.
Could you...
She coughed and took a breath.
She said, "Do you still have that handwritten copy of Chapter 17? It was your father's copy."
I should have persisted.
I should have asked her what she wanted to tell me, but Aiming seemed so fragile. It was as if I had become the older sister and she the younger.
I told her, "Of course. It's right here on the bookshelf, beside the set we photocopied in San Francisco, remember? I can see it from where I'm standing. This summer, we'll come to New York. I promise."
I miss your voices. Sometimes I'm on the subway for hours each day. I feel like a child in the underworld. And I imagine all kinds of things. The netherworld is a kingdom of its own, with its own prefectures, magistrates, and government. It's supposed to be another city entirely.
I am lovesick for some lost paradise. I would rise free and journey far away.
Do you know this poem?
Her words frightened me.
I mean, don't lose hope now. Not when you've worked so hard. Oh, Mali, it's not that I'm unhappy. Far from it. I just want to take another step. I want to live.
Before saying goodbye, I had written down her new telephone number on the same page as my solution from the continued fraction of the square root of D.
but when Ma tried to reach Aiming that night, the line was disconnected. I feared that I had misheard or made an error transcribing it, yet her voice had been so precisely, perfectly clear. When Ma tried to reach Aiming's mother, the line rang, but no one answered. 2 weeks later, a letter arrived. Aiming said that her mother's health had suddenly deteriorated, and she was going home. She told us not to worry about her, that very soon she would be able to visit us in Canada. I had wanted to give Aiming my email address, marie.jiang1979@pegasusmail.com. We had just set up the internet at home, and this was the first address I'd ever had. I knew it meant we would never lose touch. We would be able to communicate almost instantaneously. Each afternoon, when I arrived home from school, I was convinced there would be a letter or a voicemail, but there was only quiet. A chi that became a friction in the air. When summer came, we flew to New York and took the subway to Aiming's last known address. One of her roommates, Ida, an older woman, said that she had warned Aiming not to go. If the INS found out she'd left the country, Aiming's application would be thrown out. Worse, if she was caught re-entering, she'd be barred from the United States for a decade. Ida herself had just been granted amnesty under the same program. She gave us directions to the plastic flower factory where Aiming had been working, but when we arrived, no one in the office would speak to us. Finally, just as we were leaving, a teenaged girl ran out. She spoke to us in Cantonese. She said that Aiming had been expected back weeks ago, but had never turned up. Not knowing what else to do, Ma and I wandered through Chinatown, carrying a photograph of Aiming from restaurant to restaurant. One after another, people studied the picture and shook their heads. Neither of us had ever been to New York before, and I felt like a blade of grass in a world of fish. Every vehicle, it seemed, was in disguise, dressed up as a yellow cab. Ma, dazed, barely seemed to notice the city. As if in a dream, we walked across the Brooklyn Bridge, above the rippling water. That night, Ma used her credit card so that we could attend a concert in Carnegie Hall. In the foyer and the main hall, I studied every face, row after row, up the steep balcony until everything disappeared into shadow. A poem from the Book of Records lodged in my thoughts. Family members wander, scattered on the road, attached to shadows. Longing for home, five landscapes merge into a single city. The music, Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, which my father had performed decades ago with China's Central Philharmonic, made Ma weep. I sat in the dark, grown up now. I felt too wide, too full of feeling for the small space I inhabited. On the plane home, I told Ma it was only a matter of time before Aiming contacted us. All we could do was wait. After Ma's diagnosis in 1998, everything changed. We no longer fit into the hours, days, and weeks of our regular world. She began to speak of the future not as an open and undetermined place, but as a fixed measure of time. A year, maybe two, if she was lucky. Her pragmatism hurt me. I was only 19 years old, and needed to believe she would be the one to defy the numbers. When her chemotherapy began, I had been at university, a mathematics major at last, and I could think of all sorts of statistical reasons why she should not die. I spent many hours brooding over just this problem, as if Ma's life and death were a simple question of numbers and probabilities. To my surprise, but probably not to Ma's, All the anger I had stored up since my father's death returned. When I looked at my university classmates, I heard in their voices and saw in their lives a freedom I felt had been unfairly taken from me. How oblivious they seemed of their good fortune. I compensated by studying harder, by trying to outdo everyone, to defy what? I didn't know. It's no wonder that I became such a solitary young woman. I was irrationally upset with Ma, and angry all over again with Ba. I saw that I might lose my mother no matter what the numbers said, no matter how many things she still had left to experience. As usual, Ma let me think what I wanted. In the meantime, she altered her diet and dealt with the unending bureaucracy of sick leave, sick pay, health and life insurance, the web of paperwork and medication that quickly encircled her life, so that the measurement of time became divorced from the rising and falling of the sun, and became instead about the intervals between treatment regimens, hospital stays, meal times, rest and recovery. She made a will and left a sum of money to Ai Ming, which to this day has not been claimed. Neither I nor my mother's lawyer have been able to locate her. That year, I published a paper in a prestigious mathematics journal, and I am glad that Ma lived to see this small success, this glimpse of a future stability. During those long hours at the hospital, I willed myself to understand everything there was to know about algebraic geometry. Somehow, the impossibility of my task saved me. I wrote my papers and tried to find my mother's strength within myself. In the last 2 years of her life, I changed. Ma's diagnosis was an end, but also a beginning, a period of time intensely lived. We were lucky, because finally we had time to talk, to go back to subjects we might not have raised in a lifetime of reserve, of quiet. In those 2 years, I knew only two constants, mathematics and Ma. I learned a great deal about the tenacity of love, and also the terrible pain of letting it go. The brevity of my parents' lives has shaped me. In 1999, Ma asked me to find Ai Ming. "You're the only one who knows," she said. What did I know, I wondered. What had I truly understood back then? "I'll try, Ma." I couldn't find her. I tried so hard, but I couldn't do it. There's no more time. But what if there had been an accident? What if Ai Ming had passed away? I wanted to say these things, but could not imagine speaking the words aloud. The painkillers made her words slow and heavy. "She went back to Beijing. Maybe Shanghai. I'm sure of it."
"I'll look, Ma."
"I wrote a letter to Ai Ming."
"How?"
"I sent it to her mother in Shanghai. But it was returned. Her mother had moved. There was no forwarding address. I called that number so many times."
Ma's eyes filled with tears.
"I promised her mother that I would take care of Ai Ming. I gave her my word. They were family to us."
"Please don't be upset," I said. "Please, I'll find them."
"Look straight ahead, and don't turn back. Don't follow illusions. Don't forget to come home."
It was as if she could see into the future. She knew I would take on my father's regret and guilt.
"You're listening to me, aren't you, Marie?"
"Li Ling." "You don't have to worry about anything, Ma. I promise." Not once did she ask for my father. Yet I believe that somehow it was the same, that to hope for Ai Ming was also to hope for his return. Before she passed away, Ma gave me a photograph Ai Ming had left us. The picture was a duplicate of the one Ai Ming carried, which had belonged to her father. It showed Sparrow, Kai, and Zhu Li. On the back, my mother had written, Shanghai Conservatory of Music, 1966. My mother died 15 years ago, but I have been thinking about her more than ever, the way it felt when she put her arms around me, about her qualities, especially her loyalty, pragmatism, and quickness to laughter. She wanted to give me a different example of how to live my life and how to let hers go. And so, at the end, her words were contradictory. Look forward or look back. How could I find Ai Ming and also turn away from my father? Or did she think both acts were the same thing? It's taken me years to begin searching, to realize that the days are not linear, that time does not simply move forward, but spirals closer and closer to a shifting center. How much did Ma know? How will I know when to stop looking? I think it's possible to build a house of facts, but the truth at the center might be another realm entirely. It's possible that I have lost track of the dates, the time, the chapters and permutations of the story. That afterwards, I reconstructed what I could about Ai Ming's family and mine. Years later, certain images persisted in my memory. A vast desert, a poet who courted beautiful swirl with a story not his own, music that made not a sound, and I returned to them with a greater frequency. I wanted to find her again, to let her know what I remembered, and to return something of what she had given me. Even now I send letters to all the last known addresses. When I walk through our old neighborhood, Ai Ming's voice comes back, as does my mother's. I wish to describe lives that no longer have a physical counterpart in this world, or perhaps, more accurately, lives that might continue if only I had the eyes to see them. Even now, certain memories are only growing clearer. Once more, Sparrow recited the letter he had received from Wen the Dreamer. It had its own cadence now, the pulse of a libretto. My dear friend, I trust this letter finds you well, and that you remember me, your dreaming friend. The previous night, Sparrow had told Swirl and Big Mother about the letter, reciting it by heart. Big Mother had punched her knee joyfully, and then punched the other one. The puny bird picks up all the news.
So it's true, Swirl said. I knew it was true.
For a moment she appeared as Sparrow remembered her, long before the camps, a teenaged girl outrunning the war.
If he contacts you again, tell him to go to the plant and flower clinic of the Lady Dostoevsky, Notes from the Underground, Lanzhou City, Gansu Province.
Notes from the Underground? Sparrow repeated. Lanzhou City.
You'll take care of Zhu Li, won't you?
Between Ba Lut and me, Zhu Li will want for nothing. I promise. Be vigilant. Keep your wits about you, Big Mother said. Shanghai is full of walking sticks. She meant informers and spies. Beside her, the rucksacks, packed and waiting, hunched together like conspirators.
I will.
Light from the moon slid through the window, gathering in Big Mother's water basin. Slapping her belly like a drum, she recited, Moonlight in front of my bed. I took it for frost on the ground. I lift my head, gaze at the mountain moon, lower it, and think of home.
To Sparrow, she said roughly, "Watch over your father. He has no clue how to live without me." Her eyes reddened. "Be careful, Ma." Big Mother laughed, a cackling that sliced across moon and water. Perhaps one day in the future, Sparrow thought now, as he lay in bed, he would write an opera about the life of Win the Dreamer, and how the messenger sets out to Hubei province to find the mysterious Comrade Glass Eye, bringing a copy of a copy of a copy of the Book of Records. The opera would open with a flourish, with a bravado of Shostakovich, before modulating towards the aligned, careful beauty of Kurt Weill, a libretto from Mayakovsky. The streets are brushes, the squares are palettes, the thousand-paged book of time says nothing about the days of revolution. Futurists, dreamers, poets, come out into the street. And Li He, yellow dust, clear water under three mountains, the change of a thousand years is rapid as a galloping horse.
In the distance, China is nine wisps of smoke,
and in a single cup of water, the ocean churns. Could such an opera be more than an idea, a counterfeit, an imitation? Could he sit down and write an original work, a story about the possible future, rather than the disputed past? How difficult would it be to track down Comrade Glass Eye? Surely, in the village of cats, outside of Wuhan, he would be easy to find. 2 days later, he told Ba Lut that he had accepted the conservatory's commission to collect folk songs in Hebei province. His composition student, Jiang Kai, would accompany him during the 6-day trip and serve as research assistant. Sparrow even showed his father the steel wire recorder and wire reels he had borrowed from the conservatory. Ba Lut nearly levitated with pride. He unpacked crumbling maps and expired train schedules. He weighed Sparrow down with letters for long-lost comrades from headquarters, until Flying Bear giggled and said, "It doesn't work for China Post, Ba." Da Shan said morosely, "Who knows if your friends are still alive?" Ba Lut gaped at him. Sparrow gathered up the letters and said, "Don't worry, Ba. I'll deliver them all." Julie tapped her fingers on the cracker in her hand, swept her long hair over her shoulders, and said, "Careful with that ruffian." He smiled and resumed packing, and she slowly ate her cracker. She whispered to him, "I'm not going anywhere until my mother gets back. She and Big Mother must be halfway to the desert by now. You'd like me to go with you and Zhang Kai, wouldn't you?" He kept packing. Zhu Li continued, "I would love to, but what if there's a visitor or a message from my father?" And she stared at him with her searching eyes. "Yes," Sparrow said. "Good idea." Then he told her, "Think only of your concert, Julie. Practice every moment. Don't let this opportunity slip away. Think what it will mean to your parents if the party allows you to study overseas." She blinked away sudden tears. "I won't let them down, cousin." He met Kai at the bus station early the next morning. Beside the squat buildings, the ration lineups shifted in blurred congestion, winding around corners and disappearing into the horizon. The streets felt tense and watchful. When their bus flapped open its doors, they managed to find two seats near the back, over the tire. Kai insisted on carrying the wire recorder. Meanwhile, Sparrow held his erhu against his chest and tried not to be crushed. More and more people shouldered on, and the bus seemed to expand and contract like a lung, and then only contract. A supremely old lady folded herself onto Sparrow's seat, and he found himself squeezed against Kai's shoulder. As the bus bounced onto Jintang Road, Sparrow saw the city change. The concrete blocks giving way to open spaces, patches of light gliding into the flat lands of the outskirts. Kai's unruly hair shuddered in the breeze. Sparrow began to sweat. The bus labored on. At some point, he must have fallen asleep. He woke up to find Kai's arm around him, protecting him, and the Erhu, from the old lady who had the concentrated heft of a bowling ball. Inch by inch, she was appropriating the seat, and at the same time cracking sunflower seeds in her teeth. Sparrow tried to return to the dream he'd just awoken from, which involved Herr Bach seated before a comically small pianoforte, playing number 13 of the Goldberg Variations in order to demonstrate a particular subtlety of strict counterpoint. The composer's name brought together the words ba, longing, and he, awe. Bach's face was as solemn as the moon. In the sticky, sweaty rocking of the bus, music rippled in his memory as he walked on stepping stones marked Bach, Bach. Sparrow fell asleep again. Kai woke him in Suzhou. They alighted, as if drunk, from the bus. Inside Sparrow's rucksack, the 31 notebooks of the Book of Records, all mimeographed except for the hand-copied Chapter 17, elbowed against his back, as if he were carrying Da Wei and May 4th on his shoulders. They sprinted to catch the bus to Nanjing, which had just begun to pull away. The bus groaned forward, and the ticket-taker waved them up to the roof to find a space among the chickens, the students, and the baggage. Kai climbed up first, then turned, reached down and grabbed Sparrow's arm just as the bus was picking up speed. When Sparrow looked dizzily up, all he saw was the pianist's earnest face against the white sky. And then, panicking and holding on for dear life, he was hoisted up beside Kai. The students on the roof made space for the bewitching Kai, who naturally took center stage. The pianist could speak with both the quick step of the city and the balladry of the countryside. He was a one-man book of songs and book of history. Kai told a sly joke that made the boys howl and the girls smile knowingly. The grip of Kai's hand on his had left a bruise on Sparrow's skin, and it ached to the teetering of the bus.
"Teacher," the pianist said, touching his arm briefly, "won't you play a song to light our way?"
A teasing affection gleamed in Kai's eyes and made the girls draw closer.
"This comrade," he told them, "is our nation's most celebrated young composer. Believe me, you'll remember this day for the rest of your lives."
Sparrow ignored him, tuned his erhu, and swept them into Fine Horses Galloping, which got the boys whooping and the girls singing. A red-cheeked beauty with sparkling eyes somehow ended up at his knee. When he finished, she asked him to play it all over again, which he did, before segueing into The Night of Shanghai. As he played, he remembered standing on the round tables of the tea-houses, singing Jasmine to the rattling of coins and the offerings of tea and melon seeds, his mother and Aunt Swirl harmonizing with him, back when he first imagined that all the world was a song, a performance, or a dream, that music was survival and could fill an empty stomach and chase the war away. The students sang and shouted, and the driver thundered at them to keep it down, and the passengers below yelled, "Cao Dan," Satan, and sent other furious epithets up at them, but these only dissipated harmlessly away. Kai suggested Sparrow play Bird's Eye View, which was apt and also full of melancholy. He did,
and Kai sang, and by the end of the tune, the affectionate girl at Sparrow's side had tears in her velvety eyes. And he thought he could hear old people sobbing down in the belly of the bus. The afternoon passed, and twilight descended, slowly at first, then ever more quickly. Along the motorway, towns jumbled out into smaller and smaller buildings, until finally the land won out, ever vast and golden and infinite. Now and then, a handful of passengers would leap off, and someone else would climb up. In the fading light, he saw Kai watching him, and he felt the pianist's hand on his shoulder, then the back of his neck, then along the thinness of his spine. The girl was pressed against Sparrow's other arm, and the clean sweetness of her hair radiated up a pensive fragrance, hopeful as a bouquet of winter flowers. The party said that desire, like intellect and skill, was a tool for struggle. But love, if it served the smaller self before the greater one, the individual before the people, was a betrayal of revolutionary ideals, of love itself. He watched the lowlands disappear, giving way to higher altitudes and drier winds. Quilts were unrolled, thermoses opened, and wisps of steam plaited together and curled into the night sky. Sparrow slept under the protection of stars and a half-moon, hidden by a cover he shared with Kai, in the warmth of the pianist's arms. They passed small rivers and one-lane overpasses, and finally descended into a mid-sized town that looked exactly like other mid-sized towns. Layers of dust had covered them both, and turned them mirroring shades of mahogany. It was early morning. While they waited on a concrete bench for the next bus, Kai told him stories of his village outside of Changsha.
"My hometown is nearby, only a few hours away by bicycle. But if you visited, Teacher Sparrow, you'd think you'd gone back 100 years or more. The same faces appear and reappear. They return with every generation. An old farmer might be reborn as his neighbor's infant. A wealthy landowner might come back as an indentured farmer. In villages like mine, individuals pass away, but generations and routines cycle on forever."
The pianist shifted his rucksack, looked out into the steady traffic of bicycles and wobbling trucks, and a storm of swallows that had gathered on the opposite bench.
"But one day, when my father himself was a child," Kai continued, "a new school opened in the next town. The school was run by a trio of former shopkeepers who had been converted to Christianity by Jesuit missionaries. These three oiled their hair and wore black cassocks so long they swept the ground. They were pious men, and also entrepreneurs. As soon as they arrived in town, they took over two shops and converted them into a church and a school. Instead of tuition fees, they asked the farmers to pay them in vegetables and grain, in labor to maintain the buildings and harvest the land, and in faith to their God, who seemed to be a well-fed baby from Tianjin, carried in the arms of an empress and swaddled in celebratory clothes. People admired the baby because he was a cheerful god of prosperity, and every week the three priests would gather the faithful in their church and play music on a small piano that, they said, had come to China 200 years ago on a ship brought by Italians who had floated up the Yangtze River. But how this musical instrument went from the Italians to the three priests, no one knew. My father," Kai added, "was a village schoolteacher himself, who farmed a few acres of land. He sent me to the priests when I was very small because he wanted to find out more about this piano. Actually, we were believers in a way. We had complete faith in the things the priests provided: food, loans, education, and medicine. And so I went and studied with all my heart," Kai said. I wasn't the cleverest child in my class, but I was sensitive. So desperately did I want to escape my village that I even felt sorry for the grass that grew in that blighted place. I assumed that every village on Earth must look like this, so I fantasized about going far away, to the moon or another planet. The three priests, meanwhile, mistook my desire to change my life for authentic faith, that is, a child's pure longing for the sacred. They embraced me as one of their own. When I was 6 years old, they began to give me lessons on the piano. I don't know how they really acquired these instruments, but they had enough to form a chamber ensemble. They also had a good library. I learned to play a little bit of everything, violin and viola, organ, flute, even the horn. But I always went back to the piano. The keys felt like part of my body. The piano, I thought, came from that outer, better world, from the sky, and not from the dirt. My practice was so unruly that my fingers went numb, and I even bruised my fingertips. Anyway, I sang and learned solfège and counterpoint, and the priests told us that music would free us from the discontent of our lives, that we need no longer be reborn as rats or serfs or even rich men, because we are all part of the same design, all children of the same heaven. So, when Chairman Mao came with his liberating army, when the land restitution corps arrived, when the landlords were rounded up and disposed, when some were buried alive, when the peasants were raised up to party secretaries, we were already prepared and willing to accept this new state of affairs. As Mencius says, a benevolent man cannot be rich. We had already been told that we were equal, and that the gates were open to us, and we need only choose to walk through. The three priests were convinced that communism was God's design. Kai smiled ambiguously. Still, despite the great revolution that I witnessed, I felt my destiny was to leave this village. But after land reform, what happened to the school, the priests, and the piano? Sparrow asked.
Kai shrugged. He seemed irreconcilably separate from the scene he was describing.
The school is still there, and the priests continue to teach. In fact, during the land reform campaign, the head priest, Father Ignatius, became party secretary for the commune. He took the lead in repossessing land on behalf of the town, and he condemned every landlord, even though the church was a landlord itself. The priests gave up their holdings and proclaimed Chairman Mao the second coming of their liberator. So, even after revolution, people's lives continued in cycles and not straight lines. I go home every spring festival to play for them, and they ask me, quietly, if I have been true to God. In my heart, I take God to mean the party, the country, and my family. And I say yes. When the famine began in 1959, the priests showed they were only men after all, and had no idea how to multiply fish or loaves. My mother, father, and two sisters all died that winter. Even Father Ignatius starved to death.
He shifted his bag and rested it on his knees, partially blocking his face.
I watched them starve. I was the youngest and the only son, and they did everything to protect me. Our village cadres blocked letters to distant families. Anyone caught trying to leave the village was arrested. The punishment was severe. If you've never been hungry, you can't imagine. When I first came to Shanghai, I saw that it might as well have been a different planet. People had not... They knew nothing about the famine or the ruin. When I was young, I was determined to fit into this new world, to save myself, because Shanghai was a paradise. They were silent. Finally, Sparrow said, "To come to Shanghai at all, to go from your village to the city is like crossing the ocean." Kai nodded. "After my parents died, one of the music teachers saved me. Because of my ability, he sent me to live with a friend of the family, a learned man, a professor of literature here at Jiao Tong University. He was the first from our village to go to university. He has been like a father to me ever since I was 10 years old." "Imagine." Kai's laugh was sharp and sad. "A stuttering, know-nothing child, suddenly clean and tidy in a professor's salon. 6 years later, I still call him professor. I like to think that if he had sons of his own, they would address him in the same way. You'll understand when you meet him. I sat like a turnip while his students and colleagues debated and shouted. Sometimes I felt like an animal, brought in from the forest. I know that I reminded the professor of himself long ago, but I could play. I could play Bach and Mozart, even while my education, my language, was rudimentary. I was determined to rise to a new position in life. I had to learn to emulate the professor and his circle in every way, in their clothing, their habits, and their language. Outside, in the streets, the party might proclaim a new order, an end to feudalism, an uprising against the old class prejudices, but in the professor's salon..." Kai's voice dropped to almost a whisper. "The old order was still preserved. I don't blame him. A child of the countryside, you see, doesn't easily glorify the countryside. But because of the professor's friends, my thinking has changed. Shanghai, I've come to realize, is not big enough for me, and will never satisfy all the questions of my soul. I have split into too many people. I blame the priests, who instilled in me the idea of a better world, and the faith that I was destined for greater things. I blame the professor, too, who once opened my mind, but is now limited by nostalgia for the past. I want to make my parents and my sisters proud. I want to rise higher still. Do you feel as I do, teacher? Your music has meant everything to me. It showed me... I ask myself why your symphonies are never performed, and I think it's because they make us feel so much. They make us question not only who we are, but who we aim to be. Fu Tong has married the daughter of Yehudi Menuhin. He plays the piano from London to Berlin, and yet his parents are criticized as bourgeois elements. We pianists are not to follow his example despite everything he has accomplished. But surely we would better serve the people if we were part of the greater world. Why shouldn't your music be celebrated in Moscow or Paris or New York?" The young man spoke with complete confidence, a childlike determination that seemed to Sparrow like a residue from another time. And yet, like some of the other students Kai's age, he also spoke as if there was no distinction between teacher and student, father and son, no formality. They had been born only 10 years apart, Sparrow thought. But it was as if they had grown up in different centuries. "My music," Sparrow said finally. "When I was young, all I wanted was to write my music, nothing more. And that is still what I feel. I hear something else in your compositions. I hear a gap between what you say and what you desire. The music is asking for something more. I'm certain we are the same." He turned and looked directly into Sparrow's eyes. "I no longer wish to live with restraints, teacher. I wish to cast off the ordinary. The professor has come to fear the revolution. I do not. I wish the awakening of our times to waken me as well. We can't simply learn from Western art and music. We also need to examine and criticize our daily experience and our own thought.
We shouldn't be afraid of our own voices. The time has come to speak what's really on our minds.
The bus came at that moment, and Sparrow was saved from having to respond. They spent the first 2 days in the villages outside Wuhan collecting music, and 2 days in Wuhan City itself, including an afternoon at the gong and cymbal factory. Each time Sparrow delicately mentioned the name Comrade Glass Eye, his inquiry was met with confusion or curiosity, but mostly indifference. On the fifth day, however, a stranger approached them as they sat in the Red Opera tea house. He was a compact man in his late 60s, with a big, shiny head and the cloaked eyes of a gambler.
"Comrades," he said, "we were on the same bus from Nanjing. What a pleasure it is to meet you again. Tell me, how long will you stay in Wuhan?"
"At least another day and night," Sparrow said.
"I'm glad to hear it. And by the way, long live Chairman Mao. Long live the incomparable Communist Party."
His throat crackled when he said the words, and he had to stop and cough in between.
"Last night, my little niece told me she heard Shanghai musicians performing at the small Peach Gate, and I knew it must be you."
He flicked open his fan as if snapping open a knife.
"Hot, isn't it? Wuhan, you know. The furnace of the south."
As he waved the fan in slow, brutal strokes, he recounted how, before the war, he had lived in Shanghai and studied the violin briefly with Tan Hong.
"By the way, my name is Old Huang, but please address me as Jian, as my friends do. Not the Jian that means flounder, but Jian as in the mythical bird with one eye and one wing."
He pulled his chair closer towards them and whispered, full of emotion,
"Please tell me about my dear friend Tan Hong. Does he still teach at the Shanghai Conservatory?"
They spent half the morning eating melon seeds and discussing the state of music. Jian invited them to stay with him.
"It's a simple room,"
he said, lifting his right arm and fanning the top of his head.
"Hardly fit for two celebrated musicians such as yourselves, but the garden has fine acoustics. When I heard you on the bus, I realized that it's been far too long since I heard anyone play the erhu with such articulated feeling. And if I may be frank, Comrade Sparrow, I feel I already know you.
Last year at the Wuhan Cultural Palace, visiting musicians performed your string quintet in C major. It is an understatement of unforgivable proportions to say that your compositions enraptured me. Truly, such intricate counterpoint and depth of feeling is unusual in these times. Please, honor me with your presence." Sparrow accepted on their behalf. In Jian's dwelling, after a lunch of fiery noodles, they sat in the shade of a parasol tree and smoked. Sparrow felt grateful for the sun touching the top of his head and the tops of his knees, for the pale yet bitter tea and the fragrant sponge cake that Jian had divided into two large pieces, with one tiny sliver for himself. His thoughts turned inward, and he settled on the composition lecture he wanted to give on revolutionary expressionism, Schoenberg's Treatise on Harmony, and Sharapnin's essay on folk music's eternal line. "Developing variation," he would begin, quoting Schoenberg, "means that we begin with a basic unit, and from this unit elaborate the idea of a piece, as composers keep in mind fluency, contrast, variety, logic, and unity on the one hand, and character, mood, expression on the other." Just then,
Jian slapped his head as if he had forgotten to put out the brazier. He ran out and, when he returned, he carried a very old, astonishingly beautiful violin. He offered it to Kai, who in turn handed it to Sparrow, who accepted it with solemnity. Under the elderly man's watchful gaze, Sparrow tuned the instrument. He felt the thinness of the strings and the fragility of the violin's body. What music would best suit an instrument of this pedigree and seniority, he wondered. He wiped the strings down and considered the possibilities. Finally, he lifted the instrument and played the opening aria from Handel's Xerxes, and then Mendelssohn's Song Without Words. The violin was worldly wise and expressive. Sparrow glanced at Tien. Their host sat in the shadows and remembered and smiled and seemed to grow young again. When Sparrow finished, he offered the violin back to its owner.
"Now that we are familiar as brothers," Jian said, accepting it, "may I ask what brings you to Wuhan? I assume it is not just to see the renowned Guqin Terrace."
His broad forehead caught the afternoon light in a melancholic way. "Comrade Kai and I are collecting folk songs from Hebei province." After a moment he added, "And if circumstances allow, I'm looking for a friend of my family." Jian nodded. He allowed Sparrow's trust to rest in the air for a moment before answering.
"Tell me the friend's name, and perhaps I can assist you. You see, I work in the town planning office and keep track of all the permits, births, deaths, promotions, demotions, and rehabilitations. I am the keeper of all the numbers in this town, and I know them horizontally, vertically, and upside down. Our world is made of numbers," the old man said, and smiled sadly. "And long may the fires of revolution burn."
"I know this friend only as Comrade Glass Eye." Jian took up the violin, thinking. He played an echo of Handel's Xerxes, and then held a low E, D sharp, while leaning forward in his chair.
"I have a friend who suits that description, but does not normally carry that name." "You look surprised," Jian said, smiling. "But this is not so surprising, because, as you know, I am called Jian, after the one-eyed bird. This left eye, you see, is made of glass, and I have worn a prosthetic eye ever since I was a teenager."
Jian half turned his face so that he looked first at Sparrow, then at Kai, with his glass eye. Sparrow leaned towards it, mesmerized.
"My friend's name is Teacher Ai Di Sheng, and he has made my glass eye ever since I lost the original. But then, in 1958, during the Hundred Flowers campaign, he was labeled a rightist and sent to a reform through labor camp in the Northwest. A year after he was detained, my only glass eye was stolen. I was devastated. I preferred to starve and die rather than to show my empty eye cavity in this town. For many years, I wore a scarf to hide the wound. There is no eye left behind, you see."
As Sparrow stared, the eye shone with a disconcerting light.
"When Teacher Ai Di Sheng was resurrected and came home, I felt as if I, myself, had been released from the edge of the world. Without the prosthetic, I knew this society would never accept me or see me as one of its own. I had heard labor camp conditions were miserable, and so I brought him a basket of food, the best I could find under the circumstances, and some food coupons I had been saving. It wasn't much, but gifts like this were extremely rare back then. He had to make the new eye 3 times because he hadn't held a glass tube or a paintbrush in 10 years, and his hands shook continuously. I was the first to visit him, but eventually his patients began arriving from across the province. Truly, he is famous in these parts.
Carefully, Jian lifted the violin that was resting on his knee like a beloved cat and set it inside its battered case. A moment later, Sparrow felt a light rain beginning to fall.
"I'll pay him a visit this evening," Jian said. "If he agrees, we can go and see him tomorrow. Your timing is perfect, because he's been on my mind recently. Teacher Ai is not a young man, and he lives all alone."
He began to gather the tea things. When they stood to help him, he smiled and laughed again, and he seemed a young man, younger than they, as if his eye would never grow old, and it carried him along, subtly renewed.
Sparrow woke before dawn. In the small room, shapes swam out of the darkness. A writing table and the spindly leaves of a spider plant, peeling wallpaper, and a cloth cap hunched over a hook on the door. Kai's breathing seemed to come from the bed itself, from the long pillow they shared, and a quilt rumpled around them. Sparrow felt aware of every creak of the bed, and the window frames, of the nearness of the wall, and of Kai. He heard the low splash of water falling into a bucket, followed by silence, and wondered if the gentleman violinist was this very moment slipping the glass eye into its orbit. He recalled how the prosthetic had not stayed still, but had moved minutely as Jian spoke. It shifted more slowly than the other eye, as if it had a mind of its own. Kai was awake now. He turned onto his side and lightly touched Sparrow's jaw and neck, above the curve of Sparrow's collarbone. This near to one another, it was impossible to hide. All his life he had slept on mats and narrow cots beside his brothers and his classmates, but for the first time he felt the intimacy of what it meant to lie beside another person. The sudden heat in Sparrow's skin grew shameful and humiliating, but Kai did not turn away. He left his hand where it was, and then he laid his palm flat against Sparrow's chest, as if to hold him where he was, always at a remove, yet always near. Desire, or something so small as love, was subservient to revolution. This truth he knew, but the truth Sparrow felt led to another life entirely. He knew, or feared, they could not be reconciled. Outside, they heard the old man humming to himself. Kai drew back, pushed the cover aside, and got out of the bed. The sun was still low, and the town misty, when the three of them climbed into Jian's moped, a vehicle allocated to him by the town planning office. They flew along a paved road that gradually broke down into stone, then gravel, then white dust, as if they were moving through time, to an age before stones and cities, or perhaps to an era in the future. Or this is how Sparrow felt, with Kai seated behind him, the pianist's hands on Sparrow's waist, holding on against the force of their speed. Initially, he worried that Jian would not see vehicles, plow animals, or bicycles approaching from the left, and he committed himself to keeping watch. But as the town shrank and the sky brightened, he began to feel as if nothing bad could happen to them. Jian was wearing a cap with furred ear flaps, one of which was pinned up, the other flapping freely in the wind, so he seemed truly one-winged and folkloric. At length, Jian turned onto a narrow road, heading east, and navigated them towards daybreak. Past a string of houses, down a mangy dirt lane,
Arriving finally at a mud-brick house with asymmetrical gables, they came to a stop.